From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, a former Milwaukee police officer shares his perspective on recent protests and police-community relations. Then, for our Five Things to Do in Milwaukee segment, we talk about the mass demonstrations transforming our city.
You'll see a lot of folks, oftentimes almost everyone, wearing masks. There's a lot of first-time protesters, a lot of young people who this is their first moment where they feel like they can get out in the streets.
Plus, our bonus Bubbler Talk segment looks at how Black Wisconsinites are almost seven times more likely to die from COVID-19 than their white neighbors.
If you want to change health outcomes, whether it be from infectious disease or chronic diseases of living in a socioeconomic system, you need to change the nature of that system.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. Protests are still happening around the country following the death of George Floyd, a Black American who died after a Minneapolis police officer knelt on his neck. Here in Milwaukee, there have been ongoing demonstrations since last Friday, which have been largely peaceful. But tensions between police and protesters reached a high point Tuesday evening, when police used tear gas and rubber bullets to drive back protesters near downtown. Pardeep Singh Kalika has been participating in the protests, not just as a member of the Greater Milwaukee community, but also as the executive director of the Interfaith Conference of Greater Milwaukee. But Kalika isn't just an interfaith leader. He's also a former Milwaukee police officer. Kalika was a cop for 5 years in the 7th District of Milwaukee, which includes the 53206 neighborhood. He left the force to be an educator, after realizing that being a police officer didn't allow him to make the kind of impact he wanted to make. To share more of his perspective on policing, Kalika joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski and starts by explaining what made him want to become a cop.
I think I wanted to become a cop growing up in this country, there's a sense of like not having enough control in my own personal life. So I think there was a part of me that as a boy, just growing up, I wanted to have that sense of control or power. And sometimes that's the longing for. And the other part is I think I watched Bad Boys a couple too many times. And Will Smith and Martin Lawrence really got in my psyche. I'm like, oh, this is what policing is about. This is what being a cop is about. About, you know, busting bad guys and keeping good people safe. And obviously, it's not that simple.
So how quickly did your vision get disillusioned once you were in the academy, became an officer? What was the reality versus what you were expecting?
I think over time, it starts to, and it really depends on what your makeup is like. I think as soon as we started to kind of hit the streets and understand, and I'm from Milwaukee. I'm familiar with Milwaukee. I've lived in every part of Milwaukee. So it's not that I'm not familiar with it. And, you know, you definitely have people in the academy who are not familiar with Milwaukee, who are the first time that they like really step foot is the first day out on patrol. And here's the transition. You're in the academy for about 9 months. And then the next day you're assigned to a district, and then you're given a radio and a partner, and here you go. And so there's no real transition period. You're just kind of submerged into the deep of what it is. And as I started to understand the reality of day-to-day policing, I don't want to badmouth police officers. I know that their families and, you know, they take on a lot of the burdens of society, meaning that the issues that we're seeing play out right now and the protests that we're seeing play out right now are not just about policing. They're wide-scale systematic issues that police officers and other people are having to kind of navigate and deal with. The vitriol right now is directed at police, sure, but largely it's a lot of the community problems that have existed for so many years that haven't been dealt with, and really the multi-symptom problems, require multi-symptom solutions. But that complexity over time really wore on me personally, because I didn't think that I was you know, spiritually, I wasn't aligned with what I was doing on the street and on patrol. And then really, once I had my daughter, my first child, I really just had to take a good hard look at, is this what I see myself doing for the rest of my life? And it wasn't. So I quickly transitioned from, you know, being a police officer in 53206 to being an educator in 53206.
So based on your experience, do you think the culture of policing has evolved or changed? And what do you think it'll take? Obviously, that's one of the points of protest today, is the systematic change that's needed.
I think it has evolved. And as hard as it is for people to believe that, you know, that it is evolving in front of us, it is. These protests are part of that evolution. But they've been happening for so long. Right? And I feel like for certain communities, for the Black community, right? It seems to be this spin cycle of you heal from one, and then again that wound is gashed open. You heal from the next one, and it's gashed. So it's continuously traumatizing a community who sees not just a person on the screen that, you know, but they see a son, they see a father, they see a relative. So that level of communal trauma it needs to be addressed, but it also gets in the way of the evolution cycle of policing and community policing, is what we're talking about. And when we talk about, you know, for the past 8.5 years, Arnold and I have been visiting communities all over the United States and police officers who are attempting to community police. And they have their 50-page PDFs of, here's our strategies and here's our tactics and here's what we're going to do in training. But if that was going to solve the problem, if training and tactics and all these things were going to solve the problem, we would have had it solved a long time ago. But we don't have it solved. And the real issue right now is disconnection, is that you can literally see it. If you attend one of these rallies, you can literally see the level of disconnection that is there. Now you have a few officers who are engaging in the protests, engaging in the marches. You have a few politicians who are doing that. But largely, there's a disconnect that exists in our culture of all, you know, in every industry, but really this industry, where you have people who, you know, talk about the thin blue line. You have protesters or activists who are attempting to express what they're trying to say, but that expression is met with sort of a rejection of, oh, no, here's where I am. I'm behind this badge and I back this badge. So there's just a level of disconnection that I think that we really need to take a look at.
You mentioned Arno before. That's Arno Michaelis. He's a former white supremacist who's your partner in Serve to Unite. And you mentioned your efforts to help facilitate community policing. So, of course, right now there's rhetoric around, quote, one bad apple, one bad cop, or there's good cops out there. But in regards to community policing, and, you know, people are wondering why don't, quote, good cops speak out as much as they probably should. Is that really incentivized in the force to put yourself out there like that? You know, do you see it as a matter of personal will of not speaking out, or is it because a system is not encouraging this type of behavior either?
Yeah, that's a great question, Audrey. I don't look at people as if like they're either good or bad. People just do the best that they can, and people are pretty linear, meaning that they want to kind of go on with their 9-to-5, go home, do what they do, and go back to work the next day and repeat that same. And really, I think not only is there not it's not incentivized to speak up, it's almost that they're conditioned psychologically, and we all are. We all are conditioned psychologically to just go along, to get along. And there's phenomenal studies that study oxytocin. And oxytocin is sort of the loving drug, the hugging drug, one that makes us feel nurtured. And most of people have accepted this oxytocin as a good thing. But what recent studies have shown is that oxytocin can actually be a negative to the outgroup, whatever that outgroup looks like. And so it's great for the in-group. And definitely policing and all others, teaching other occupations definitely have an in-group or a subgroup that they feel close to. And so what that does psychologically, subconsciously, is take you away from whoever you think is the out-group. So combine oxytocin studies, combine that to a paramilitary structure, combine that to the level of trauma psychologically, combine that with what is happening in some of the police officers like the Derek, I forget his last name, but I'm sure that something is happening at home that is also causing some of this to be psychologically sort of straining. And you have this bad recipe where this is going to continue to happen. And then every precinct knows who the bad apples are. They are in tuned enough, but it's not incentivized, as you said, to say something. Now, there's some brave cops who do speak up. But most people will just kind of go along to get along. Or they'll say, you know, when I was at the district, I was at District 7 for nearly 5 years. What we would do was basically say to the sergeant, I don't want to work with this person. And the sergeant would say, okay, that's fine. You don't have to work with that person. And that was kind of the way that it was. There was a guy that I was put on patrol with one day who was outside of both of my partners. And I thought that he was kind of a cowboy. You know, I'm not the one to try to get into fights with, but that culture exists that I came back to the district and just told the sergeant, I don't want to work with him. Put me on one man rather than put me on two men with, and this is in 53206. This is in District 7, where most people don't go out on a single man patrol, but there's no like, hey, can we work on the culture inside? Because that requires a lot of work.
So was it circumstances like that that just wore you down to the point of not wanting to be in the force anymore?
Yeah. I mean, that's right on. That's exactly it. And I do worry that, you know, the march, I believe it was Sunday, we're marching from MLK to Pete's Market up to 7th and 7th across. It was led by a lot of faith-based organizations who were kind of up in the front. And in the middle, I'm kind of in the middle, and I see parents around me who are kind of trying to teach their children the sort of the significance of the time. And I earshot a mom who is talking to her son, who looks about 11 or 12, and she is basically telling him, you know, and as she sings hymns, as she's praying in both English and an African dialect. And I was like, wow, this is amazing that I hope this child grows up and, you know, becomes the next chief of police, becomes a police officer, becomes an educator, becomes something that comes back to the community and says, I'm going to really, really serve my community. And then in the back of the, and I'm not, you know, not all Antifa is the same. Not all protesters are the same. You know, I don't want a bad mouth. I think that people are just doing the best that they can. But in the back of the protest, there's a lot of people who are yelling obscenities. So now you got faith communities in the front. You got a mixture of parents and children, and you have protesters in the back. And I'm thinking on this child, how this child is just kind of overwhelmed by the stimuli and confused. And maybe because of the confusion, he doesn't become a cop. Maybe he doesn't become one. So I think the need is there that we have to help nurture an environment that really has community come back to community, that doesn't see success as leaving Milwaukee, but staying in Milwaukee and investing in Milwaukee. And I think there's amazing activists, there's amazing faith communities and leadership who already do that. And I would hope that what comes out of this is to say, when somebody comes out of the academy, when somebody comes and is about to go into the streets and start to patrol, why not meet with those stakeholders? Why not meet with people in the community first before you ever step out on the street? And that way you can have an alternative to policing as a control mechanism, but really say, okay, what alternative methods are there for me to not take this person into custody, but for me to help this person?
You're juggling a lot of identities when you're out there with protesters. So as a former cop, and now you're an interfaith leader. So what does your perspective of these protests look like, not just as a community leader, but as a former cop? And I'm sure your observation skills are constantly going. So what has been going through your brain?
Yeah, I've always tried to study people, and I've been intrigued by people, just the way that they navigate the world. You know, there's all kinds of factors that play into a person's experience, such as race, ethnicity, language, how long they've been here, their socioeconomic conditions, where they are as far as like age, who they like, who they don't like. So I'm always kind of just, yeah, I'm always kind of observing. And to a large extent, most of the protests have been peaceful. I've seen communities stand up time after time and block vandalism of a building, block, you know, and really teach like that mom was doing, you know, use that moment to try to teach their son, their daughter, the young ones who the children will be the future. And we really, I'm all in all, I am proud of our community. I'm proud of the communities. I'm proud of most of the police and communities for the jobs that they do. You know, I think that there needs, and when we talked about that linear pattern of 9 to 5 or whatever our normal is on a day-to-day basis, I think that people right now are making music and they are being creative. Now, sometimes that music, that vibration sounds different to different people because they're not used to the tune, right? But I think right now, overall in all, we're getting to a place where people are starting to vibrate at a different frequency. And I hope that that's the lasting message, that we don't want to see another George Floyd. And you know, thinking about even the disconnection of George Floyd, one of the other reflections was, I was like, why was it this protest? Why was it not other things that happened that woke up the consciousness of people? But what we witnessed with our own eyes is something that the spiritual psyche should never witness. We saw a person taken, basically transitioning from life to death in front of our own eyes. And the universal cry that he cried, that he basically said, was one for his mother. And a lot of people said, okay, he was crying out for his mom. Well, George Floyd's mom passed already. She wasn't alive anymore. So he wasn't calling out to his mom. He was telling his mom, who had already passed, I'm coming. Each and every one of us has to let go of life at some point. We hold on with our fingertips, kind of just clutching, and each one of us has to let go. George Floyd, we saw a man who let go before he was ever gone. And that's what woke up the consciousness of people. Didn't know what it was, but that's what it was, is that we should never have saw that or witnessed that, and we can't witness it again. And so I think all in all, people are really understanding the times. They're waking up. I would hope that people can be reverent. And, you know, if you are one of those people out there that, if you're stuck in the psyche of whatever you're stuck in, if you're a protester, let's really criticize protesting. If you're supporting policing, let's criticize policing. If I'm a faith leader, I want to criticize the faith community constructively. If I'm an educator, I want to criticize education, because all of these things are leading to the problems that we do have. So if we're going to get to a better place, we got to honestly critique what those things that we exist in, those cultures that we exist in, and how are those cultures leading to not a betterment for everyone, but making the trauma worse.
So you kind of hinted on that. Where do we go from here? But also, where do you think the leadership comes from? We're seeing people take the leadership role, protests taking leadership role, but they're hoping to affect change on policies and systems that exist beyond marching on the streets. So in your opinion, what's next?
I think this is genuine leadership. I think leadership doesn't come from a title. Leadership doesn't come from a political position. It's something that is earned. And it's not something where somebody stands in front of everyone. It's something where, you know, leadership comes from behind people, and it elevates people, and it tells people that I will walk with you. So if you are a leader in this time, you need to walk with people. You need to tell them that you support them. We are seeing, and we're giving the microphone to a lot of people who are not leaders. They might have the title of a leader, but they are not leaders spiritually. They're disconnected themselves. They're resorting to their same talking points. And when you do that, you're not elevating anyone to a better place. You're staying in that linear place. And when society is getting to a place and they're like, no, the artistry, the vibration where I need to get to, I know spiritually it sucks right now, but where I need to get to, I need to become whole. We need to become whole. We need to get to a better place. The leadership really needs to understand that betterment is a service. It is a self-service. And I think watching kids, watching most of these protests being led by just organic community leaders, that's real leadership. And like I said, it's sad that I even have to say this, but nobody is condoning vandalism of a building. Nobody is condoning violence against police officers. But that's not what this is about. So if that's what, I mean, this it is, but it's not what all of this is about. It's not the disgruntlement of what people are feeling right now. People right now are feeling disconnected. When you have officers who are standing, further away because it's tactically that their position. If you have faith leaders who are in the front marching and don't have any understanding of what's happening in the middle or in the back, we're disconnected. And we have to all be honest with that. If the church or the synagogue or the masjid is not reaching out to the people that, and inviting people in, if somebody stands outside of a church and is hurting and says to themselves psychologically, I can't go into that church because I don't feel worthy. What is it we're doing?
Pardeep Singh Kalika is a former Milwaukee police officer, and he's currently executive director of the Interfaith Conference of Greater Milwaukee. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski, and you can hear their full conversation at WUWM.com. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Every month, Adam Carr from the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service joins us to talk about some of the community events that generally happen in Milwaukee. But this month, like seemingly every month lately, is a bit different. Milwaukeeans have been marching and protesting in neighborhoods throughout the city, calling for racial justice and an end to police brutality, among other social reforms. We're also still in the middle of a global pandemic, which has many people stuck in their homes. So this month, we're highlighting some local resources to give people better insight into these protests. We're looking to our community's past and its future as we all try to understand and survive this historic moment we're a part of. Adam Carr, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect once again.
Thanks for having me, Joy.
So let's get into this. You know, the first thing that you talked about in the five things that you sent over is response.
Absolutely. I think we compiled a package. We reached out to leaders, organizers, activists, folks in the grassroots, and from a really wide variety of backgrounds. This past weekend, you know, a lot is on people's minds and hearts. I think in a lot of ways, you know, we had everyone from County Executive David Crowley, we had other elected officials, we had just organizers like Vaughn Mays and Jared English, and we offered them just an opportunity to sound off on where they are, what's going through their mind. And I will say it ended up being kind of a long read. Folks had a lot to say. We're planning to do another one of these response packages coming up soon. But I think you really can't do enough listening right now, especially for folks who are really in the thick of what's being discussed right now, which is ideas of racism, of police brutality. So yeah, this package that we compiled, I felt really proud to be part of my team in those moments when I saw all the different connections throughout our network that we're able to pull together.
And of course, the WUWM team has also been covering the protests every night. I did a bit of photography yesterday when the march came through my neighborhood here in Bayview. But you've been out through a lot of the marching. What have you seen?
I have observed it a little bit, and I would say what's really interesting about this moment, one, I just want to point out we're in a pandemic. So at marches, you'll see a lot of folks, oftentimes almost everyone, wearing masks. There's a lot of first-time protesters, a lot of young people who this is their first moment where they feel like they can get out in the streets. And I will say another piece that I would really highly endorse for your listeners. You know, you can hear through places like WWM or Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service accounts of what happened. But what's happening in this moment, which I saw happen for the first time in Milwaukee on a large scale during the Sherman Park unrest 3.5 years ago, is the use of live streams just from people who are participating in the marches, where you can see what it looks like firsthand. You know, there are activists like Vaughn Mays or Frank Nitti who are often live streaming from the front lines. There's also folks like Charlene Moore or Reggie Moore from the Office of Violence Prevention who are putting out accounts. You could be essentially standing right there with them as the marches are happening. And even Matt Wild from the Milwaukee Record has been very committed to doing this. But I guess what I'm pointing out is the ability for everyone out there listening to see what's happening firsthand, these firsthand accounts from live streams. So you can listen to folks like us talk about it, but you can also see it for yourself.
Especially during this pandemic, when there are, of course, people who can't go because they have health complications.
Absolutely. I mean, it is a moment where, from what I've seen, people are very cognizant of the fact that we're in a pandemic. But, you know, there's a lot of folks that, for one reason or another, I mean, keeping their health in mind, it makes sense to be home. So, absolutely.
So the third item, I actually had a chance to talk to Reggie Jackson over at America's Black Holocaust Museum about some of the civil rights protests that we've seen in Milwaukee throughout our history. And this third item is called the Long March to Freedom.
Absolutely. It's Milwaukee's open housing marches happened in 1967 and spilled over into 1968. They actually lasted 200 consecutive days. The full history of these marches is extreme, as you might imagine from what was just said there really quickly. It is long. It is complex. And I think oftentimes, I will say this, having grown up in Milwaukee and gone to phenomenal public schools, that story is often left out of the story that we're taught about the city of Milwaukee, at least in its totality. So Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, for the 50th anniversary, published a compilation of both looks in the present day, but also interviews with marchers who marched over 50 years ago in the open housing marches, a package named The Long March to Freedom. You can find that at our website, milwaukeenns.org/open-housing. And I think a reason to call attention to this is that there's a long history of resistance in Milwaukee, and particularly led by youth. The front lines of the open housing marches, NAACP Youth Council, the Commandos, young black folks in Milwaukee over 50 years ago taking to the streets to demand change. So I've come to know the story very well. There's certainly echoes of what was started 50 years ago and we're seeing on the streets today in 2020.
Well, and something I talked about with Reggie Jackson that I think often gets left out of this story is what the police response looked like at that time.
Absolutely. On the second day of marching, the police errantly, I'm doing air quotes, shot a tear gas canister into the Freedom House, which is the headquarters of the Youth Council, claiming they saw a sniper on the roof and set it on fire. I've gotten to know some of the Youth Council members and commandos pretty well, and they've shared with me often these intimate accounts of really, they were breaking no laws in their marches, but of them being the ones who were policed rather than the racist counter-protester. So another point I think is important to attach to that, and I'm going to circle back to something I started with, is that the Youth Council and the Commandos, they were marching alongside Vel Phillips and her resolution for open housing, which she could not get passed in the Common Council. And I want to point out, too, that there are groups like Leaders Igniting Transformation, the African American Roundtable, who are putting out essentially lists of demands that are generated from community members about what they want to see as a result of these protests. So this is all happening really quickly, but there are folks that are already putting out saying, here's what we would like to see as change resulting from the marches and protests.
This fourth item is a really important component of this movement, and I think something that a lot of people have been discussing, especially those people who've been staying home away from the protests, getting tested.
Absolutely. And this can be, I'll just say, very quickly and clearly, the health department locally, the COVID-19 on-the-spot testing is still happening. There are two sites currently. They're open Monday through Thursday, 11 a.m. to 7 p.m., then Friday and Saturday, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m., closed on Sunday. There's one site at Custer Stadium, and then there's one site at UMOS on the south side. There are other groups that have been doing kind of pop-up testing here and there, but these are the ones that the City of Milwaukee Health Department is organizing alongside the State National Guard and the county. So COVID on-the-spot testing is happening. You can go to the City of Milwaukee Health Department's website to see all that information. But if you are out marching, and even if you're not, getting tested is a critical part of knowing about your own health.
Yeah. Now, the fifth item, you know, we wanted to end this on a happy note. And I think for anybody who's driven around Milwaukee recently, you might see some little placards outside of people's homes.
Yeah, you know, this we organized last Saturday, and we've been planning this for about a month. So we wanted to celebrate the graduates. You know, that's one of the narratives we're seeing emerge, which is, man, is the class of 2020 unlucky to have all of their ceremonies, all of their celebrations canceled. And, you know, we just wanted to put out sort of a gesture to our community and said, we would love to come to your house and not get closer to you than 10 to 20 feet and take a photograph of you in your cap and gown, in your graduation outfit. And that is exactly what we did. We took photos of, I believe, 23 different graduates spread throughout the north and south side of Milwaukee. We did this on Saturday, literally as people were marching in the streets. I happened to be one of the three photographers that did it. And it was, just on a personal note, it was a reminder of kind of what this is all about. These are young people who are graduating from grade school, middle school, high school, college, who, you know, are inheriting this world. And I think, what a tumultuous time to be thinking about a future. But I think for us at Neighborhood News Service, it was a reminder of what we do all the time, which was, you know, celebrating people in our community. We also, you know, we do evidence-based journalism. That's a big part of our commitment. But being able to, you know, have this showcase of some of the wonderful young people in our community was something we're really, really happy we could do. So you could check that out on our website, milwaukeenns.org. Our beautiful, resilient graduates of class of 2020.
All right. Well, Adam Carr, thank you so much for joining us, rolling with the punches here as we all kind of figure out what's going on in our lives in Milwaukee.
Yeah. The last 3 months, we've had no idea what we can expect to talk about, even the few days before, really. So I guess I'll see you in July, and we'll see what we're talking about then.
Adam Carr is the Deputy Editor for Community Engagement at the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. You can find more of our conversations with them about Milwaukee's Central City neighborhoods at WUWM.com. Lake Effect will return in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. More of Lake Effect now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. At least 21,000 Black Americans have died from COVID-19 since the pandemic began. According to a study from the APM Research Lab, if health outcomes were more equitable in America, 13,000 of those Black Americans would still be alive today. In addition to the high-profile police killings of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, tens of thousands of Black Americans have had to grieve these preventable COVID deaths in social isolation. Here in Wisconsin, the situation is no less grim. According to that same APM study, we're third in the nation for highest COVID death rates among Black people. Last week, Lake Effect's Julian Haida answered a Bubbler Talk question about why that might be. For that story, he interviewed a geneticist named Joseph Graves, author of The Race Myth: Why We Pretend Race Exists in America. In this bonus bubbler talk, you'll hear that full interview. Julian begins by asking Professor Graves if negative health outcomes for Black Americans are inevitable.
Okay, so if we talk about race the way most people think of race as in a biological entity, then the answer is no. If we think about race with regard to the way it has been socially defined and lived in the United States, I would say that these health outcomes with regard to the coronavirus infection were in fact entirely predictable. And I did predict them early on in the epidemic, even before the data came out. So at the level of biological variation of humans, this virus is a new virus. It crossed over into the human population from bats or maybe the pangolin, which is a mammal also. But at the end of the day, there's no humans had any immunity to this virus. And so no group of humans was more or less susceptible to it. But the social conditions that people live in played the biggest role in determining who was infected and who died. And who is going to continue to die from COVID-19.
Now, whether it be in China, people are talking about how, you know, high rates of smoking tobacco maybe contributed to the high rates of death. And here in the U.S., when people talk about high rates of kind of Black fatality from COVID-19, they talk about predisposition to heart disease, diabetes. This is in medical journals as well. Now, when it comes to medical predisposition to the coronavirus through things like heart disease, through things like diabetes, how are those things socially reified versus something that might be genetic?
Well, if you look at the prevalence of heart disease and diabetes in the United States, there are socially defined populations that have a greater prevalence of these diseases. And again, people often assume that that greater prevalence is being driven by some underlying genetic difference. And in fact, there's really little to no evidence of that. And really all the evidence speaks the other way, that it's really environmental differences that are contributing to the differences in the rates of heart disease and diabetes between African Americans and European Americans. The genetic argument really just doesn't hold up when we look at genetic variants that are associated with risk of these disease. For example, with regard to hypertension, people of European descent actually have a higher frequency of the genes that predispose people to hypertension than African Americans do. So if we were going to make a genetic argument, you would expect European Americans have higher rates of hypertension and then higher rates of diabetes, and to be dying at higher rates of COVID-19. But that's, in fact, the exact opposite of what we see. So the genetic argument really doesn't stand up, but there are all sorts of environmental differences that predispose people to disease, poor diets, environmental toxins, and things of that sort, which are differentially visited on persons of African descent in the United States, and have historically been differentially visited on persons of African descent in the United States. So again, for those of us who study this problem, the COVID outbreak and its severity amongst the African American population was not a surprise, not at all.
Give us some examples of some of those environmental factors. Here in Wisconsin, the fatality rate among Black Wisconsinites is several times higher than it is in a place like LA or New York or even in Georgia. Why might that be? What would be the environmental differences between these places?
I would think that the evidence that we have right now, probably the strongest indicator of one's likelihood to come down with the disease, is your likelihood to be in contact with someone who's carrying the disease. And that's strongly related to the population density in the area in which you live. So, you know, what's called social distancing is really physical distancing. And if you live in a single dwelling that's a, you know, an acre apart from the next single dwelling, and you're relatively sufficient with regard to supplies like water and groceries, and you can call out and have those things delivered readily, then you're very likely not to come into contact with anybody who's carrying the virus. But if you live in crowded conditions, and in addition, you have, you know, multiple individuals living within your dwelling, and you either have to go to work because you're in one of these industries that's called an essential industry, like, for example, working at a grocery store or working in transportation or in working in health, you know, as a healthcare provider, then you're more likely to come in contact with the virus. And that's really the only major thing that we're seeing with regard to transmission. That is the density of individuals increasing the probability that you come in contact with someone who's carrying the virus.
I want to dig a little bit deeper into something you said earlier about population density and the spread of the coronavirus. I mean, again, a place like New York City is more dense than Milwaukee, but Milwaukee is also the most segregated city in the country. The urban-suburban divide is one that often is a racial divide. Do you think the disproportionality plays into that a little bit more given the way those lines are socially drawn? Or did New York just do a better job containing the virus?
I'm not sure that New York did a better job. New York was the first major hotspot in the United States. But I do think that patterns of racial segregation played a role in the spread of this virus. And again, the key thing is not coming in contact with somebody who has it. So if you have a community where you have disproportionate numbers of people who are likely to come in contact with the virus, and that community is itself segregated from other elements of the community, then you're going to see a much higher prevalence of the infection in that community. And if that's what happened in Wisconsin, that would explain the differential rates there. In New York, initially, we didn't have data on racial disparity, but as soon as the data came out, we saw the same thing in New York and New Jersey and other states that have large ethnic minority populations are showing the same pattern. So racial segregation does play a role in and it always has.
Now, are you afraid that given all the headlines, given all the attention that's given to the racial disparities here, that this will prove yet again to people the assumption that racial difference is genetic inherently?
Well, quite frankly, it depends upon who's spinning the narrative. And unfortunately, there are enough people presenting the old genetic race syllogism that this isn't going to change the conversation. And again, this is one of the most unfortunate things that's going to come out of this pandemic, is that it's going to be back to business as usual once people feel like they're, quote, safe. And examples of this, of course, are demonstrations in states like Michigan, where AR-15 toting persons of European descent are descending upon the state house, you know, demanding that the economy and businesses be opened up again. And if you'll note, if you look in those crowds, you know, you don't see too many people of African descent being involved in this. So quite frankly, I don't see any evidence that this narrative is going to change with regard to the social causation of disease and the social privileges that people who have, for the most part, or I won't say for the most part, but what differentially escaped the ravages of this disease are going to, in terms of their ongoing behavior. So you're right. I don't see this narrative changing at all.
So say someone is empowered to change this, though, and improve the disparities in these health outcomes. This is the wave of the magic wand question. What kind of changes would have to happen to flatten the racial disparities in something like the coronavirus?
Well, you know, I've said this over and over again, so this will be yet another program in which I say this. I don't think that any health disparities will ever be solved under capitalism. It's an economic system that creates disparity, that creates injustice, that creates differentials in wealth and health. It's simply the way the system works. It can't work any other way. And that's the great conundrum that this society refuses to face, is that the outcomes that we see in the U.S. society are directly related to how the society was structured and how it operates. So there are no reforms that are going to change health outcomes in the United States under the present socioeconomic system. It just simply can't happen. That's like asking an elephant to suddenly take off and fly. Elephants can't fly. And so if you want to change health outcomes, whether it be from infectious disease or chronic diseases of living in a socioeconomic system, you need to change the nature of that system. So, I mean, immediate things can be done. For example, having a single payer insurance. So what Bernie Sanders was campaigning on, Medicare for all. Okay, no one in the United States should be without appropriate health care. And what I mean by that is that the health care that the richest people in this nation get, the poorest people in this nation should have as well. And even if, you know, you don't believe in that kind of social equity with regard to care, you should be self-motivated to want that to happen. Because whenever you have people who don't have access to health care, that means that they're going to be far more likely to become infected with a transmissible disease and to spread that transmissible disease. And since even wealthy people rely on poorer people to be able to live in their daily lives, and what I mean by that is the people who work in the meat packaging plants, the people who work in agriculture, the people who work keeping the lights on, the people who work, you know, educating your kids, you're not going to be able to stay away from infectious disease because the disease doesn't know any color line and it doesn't know any class line with regard to its capacity to infect individuals. So even if you thought this is a terrible thing, it actually is the best thing with regard to being able to control infectious disease. And what I mean by that is if everyone has access to appropriate healthcare, then we're able to both monitor the onset of infectious disease and stop its spread. Okay, so we need to start with those kinds of changes. But at the end of the day, unless we change the fundamental ways in which we live, we are going to have pandemic after pandemic after pandemic, and it's always going to be poor people and racially subordinated people who die the most.
I wanted to ask one more question, and this is a little bit more theoretical. Say the economic system completely gets overhauled, and yet, you know, we like our kind of our cultures, especially marginalized cultures. How do those cultures persist without necessarily falling to the kind of nationalist discourses of we are the best racially and ethnically, no matter how groups might be stratified economically and otherwise?
Well, I've never been a champion of the superiority of one culture over another. My view is that cultures have evolved, they have differences, but even within, you know, if you look at the overall characteristics of human cultures, we share far more in common than we are different. And so, you know, people try to, and in some sense as a response to being subordinated, try to uplift different aspects of their culture, and they use it as a rallying cry in a way to make the oppression not as bad as it is. I've never done that. There are things that I appreciate in all human cultures. And there are amazing parallels. Like if you listen to Mississippi Delta blues and you see it as a cultural art form, there are similar art forms that evolved independently all over the world. I mean, Okinawan blues is amazingly similar to Mississippi Delta blues. And the two cultures had no direct contact. So again, it underscores the unity of the human experience. And that's always been what I have championed as a scholar and as an activist, is what holds us together. And I think that's where we need to be with regard to moving forward to making a just and equitable world. We have to emphasize the things that we share, the things that all human beings need, the things that all human beings appreciate. And that's the thing I want to emphasize in my discourse about moving our nation and the world forward towards something that I would call just and equitable.
Yeah. It's just way too easy to rest on those laurels of biological difference. That's why we call you.
Because biology is destiny is a simple explanation, and it's used to cover up the more fundamental dynamics of injustice.
Joseph Graves is Associate Dean for Research and Professor of Biological Studies at the Joint School for Nanoscience and Nanoengineering. He's also the author of The Race Myth, Why We Pretend Race Exists in America. He spoke with Lake Effect's Julian Haida for last week's edition of Bubbler Talk, which you can hear at WUWM.com or by downloading the Bubbler Talk podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Audrey Nowakowski and Julian Haida join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from our executive producer, Becky Mortensen. Special thanks to our managing editor, Michelle Matanowski, for additional support this week. We also heard from Mayan Silver, Emily Files, and Taryn Powell from the WUWM news team this week. Lauren Sigfusson is our digital producer, Jack Urbanis is our digital intern, and Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Willie Porter wrote our theme music.